Welcome to the June 16th, 2020 session of TeamSpeak, sorry, version of Zoom for Tangerine SDR. My name's Dave, KB0S, and this week I've actually been editing papers in LaTeX, so that's kept me busy, including one of the papers is I've been working on a chapter from Tom's book, so that's making some progress. I hope to have something to share with the Tapper board next week to see if they think I'm doing an okay job or not. Anyway, so that's about it for me. Next on the list, I'm going to use the participant list that I have, and the next one I have is Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
All right. Thank you very much, Dave. It's been quite a busy week for me. Rachel, Anthony, and I moved to the new QTH, as I was showing, and the move went very smoothly. We're quite happy, and we already have a ham radio antenna set up. So I think I owe Bill a QSO, a SCED. Let's see. And then aside from that, I've been working with Dev and Bill Lyles on the, and we met with Juha Virnin. So we actually met with Juha on Zoom, and we talked about ionospheric sounding, passive ionosound. So maybe Dev can talk about that in a couple minutes. I've been working with Veronica and training her on how to do data analysis in Python. And I'm starting to work on some more grant proposals, so that's going to keep me busy. And I have been working on an invited presentation for the CDAR workshop about the personal space weather station. So I've been putting that together, and I need to record that, make that video tomorrow, and then submit it. So it's been quite a busy week here. W2NAF back to you.
Very good. Next on my participant list, I have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave, for running the show again. And thanks to Mike for recording, or posting the recordings, I guess. It's a little bit different than TeamSpeak, huh? So anyway, this week didn't get much done on SDR stuff because, as you know, the date for move out of our building is looming. So we only have about 15, now it's days, it's 15 days left. See, now it used to be months, then it was weeks, and now it's only days left. So it's been a big chore getting an 8,000 square foot building cleared out after the accumulation, 10 years accumulation of junk. So that's got to be taking my priority because on July 6th, whatever isn't out gets gone. Somebody else gets it. So at least take the valuable stuff, right? Anyway, back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, Scotty. And next on the list, we have Dev. Go ahead,
hello.
Dev.
Hello. Good evening, everybody. So I had the pleasure of being invited to Nathaniel's house. And I went there. I had a very pleasant evening. I think yesterday, it was right yesterday. And we have, we talked to a ham and it was a live conversation. And I was surprised the live conversation was very lively, even with a stranger. I asked him afterwards and he said like, well, did you know him? He said, no, like I just, that's how we know here in the ham community. And that was a fun thing to know, okay? And apart from that, we have placed orders for the equipments that we placed. They are on the way. They are GPS oscillator kit, GPS antenna, magnetic mount, daughter board, and USRP N200, the SDR. So, and there are a few other cables, etc. And all of them are on the way. And once they reach, we'll try to assemble them and build our PSWS, and we'll try to receive signals, available signals of opportunity. We're aiming to receive CHOP ionosonde, oblique ionosonde signals, which are already in the operation. And we discussed with Juha from Norway how to process those signals. Like he has it in open source in his GitHub. And we will take his, we are essentially starting with replicating what he has done. And later on, like if we succeed with that, we'll try to add instruments, like add more complexities to this, our initial personal space weather station. But I think in a week or two, we will be able to make a start. And moreover, in New Jersey, we already have all of this assembled together, but that is functioning for a different purpose. And we are requesting Ethan Miller to allow us to operate that for our goal of using it as personal space weather station to detect a signals of opportunity. So I think slow and steady, we are taking mini steps towards the direction.
Very good, Deb. So next on the list, we have Tom Yarnish. Any comments quickly?
All right, well, not much. I'm a fly on the wall here. I've been following the Hamside group for a while. I do a lot of whisper work, and I'm looking for receiver improvements, particularly interested in the Tangerine and how that unfolds. And, you know, just looking for opportunities to join in and be useful someplace. I've a lot of antennas here in the field and always putting up more, working with the CATS Ham group, Rob Robinette and others, Glenn Elmore on a lot of projects. And just want to stay up with what's going on. Love this group and happy to be here just monitoring.
Very good. And next on the list, we have Bill. Off the top of my head, I can't remember it. Go ahead, Bill.
Latest thing I did was participated in the ARRL VHF contest over the weekend, and 6 meters was wide open, so it was amazing. So worked several hundred QSOs, including a bunch of new countries in Europe, which is on 6 meters. It's amazing. But anyway.
Is that FT8?
FT8? Right. Yeah, I used FT8 because it's just so easy and quick, but the sideband and CW were also open as well. So if you participated in it, but it's 6 meters going great guns. I see it's open now. But anyway, on this project, I got the package working to where from the central, I have a very dumb simulator of the central host working where it can request files from the Tangerine between a given start and end date time, and the Tangerine will get them, package them up, and send them while the ring buffer and Tangerine and everything is running. So we got that working. Next thing I'm working on now is I'm wanting to be able to work with some actual off-the-air data since we're running a little bit behind on the data engine. What I'm doing now is I dug out my Pi HPSDR code, and it talks to the Raspberry. It talks to not the Raspberry. It talks to the Red Pitaya, and so I'm genning that up. So the Red Pitaya and this my version of HPSDR code will output data that is compatible with the design for the Tangerine output, as long as you're running a single band and 48K samples per second. That's kind of what you're limited to on the Red Pitaya. So I'll be able to simulate that. And with that, I'll be able to make sure that everything works with the ring buffer. I'm going to code up a thing to do a discrete Fourier transform on that and spit out files that are compatible with what the Case Western Reserve team is doing in a couple of flavors. One, to pick the loudest frequency in the passband, and the other one is to just spit out a comma separate variable file of probably 32767 bins of data coming off of the an FFT of the data, and then you can analyze that using something as simple as Excel just as a sanity check to make sure that the signals you're seeing look like kind of what looks like the histogram coming out of HPSDR code, because it does have a GTK output which allows you to see what the signals look like in a visual sense. So anyway, making a good deal of progress on that. So back to Ned.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Hopefully we have your voice this time.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's working. Can you hear me okay? All right, great.
Fine.
So, yeah, I think last week it was either software, hardware, or the operator. I'm not sure one of those three was the culprit, but I did reinstall Zoom, and everything seemed to work correctly after the reinstall. So whatever the real reason was, that seemed to fix the problem. This week I did a little bit of messing around with GenPy 64, which is a 64-bit Gen 2 operating system for the Raspberry Pi 3 and 4. And it seems to work pretty well. I had some issues getting the sound set up with the HDMI display that I have. For some reason, it wasn't trivial doing that, but I was able to get it sorted out. Other than that, it worked a little bit on scripts. I have kind of an issue with scripts because the big issue is that different operating systems have different packages, and the scripts have to have a fairly well-defined package set in order to be easily transferable. And it's sometimes a question of different names for the same package. It sometimes is different packages entirely. So that's been a little bit of a challenge, but I've also experimented a little bit with actually generating packages for specific distributions from source code in a script. And that seemed to work fairly well. For example, on the Raspberry Pi or on Raspbian or the Raspberry Pi OS, you're missing libsound.io, I think, -dev. And I ended up actually downloading the source code for that and compiling it, which is not trivial in a script, believe me. Anyway, that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave. Thanks.
Well, I did get those sets of scripts and appreciate them. I haven't had a chance to use them on Raspberry Pi, but I read through them, and they all made sense to me from looking at them.
Well, they're somewhat perishable. I tried to make them as generic as I could, in that if you specify specific versions of software and then the version changes, it breaks the script.
Right.
So, you know, you have to be careful. I did run both of the ones that I sent out as recently as yesterday, and they worked okay.
Okay.
So at least up through yesterday, you were in good shape. So hopefully they'll stay alive for a few more days. I'll try to keep going back and redoing them and seeing if I can't make sure that they're working. Okay. If they aren't, I'll modify them to the point where they work. So anyway, that's it.
Next on the list, we have Elizabeth Hernandez. Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I have no updates right now, so just wanted to say hi to everyone.
Well, hello. Next, we have, let's see. This is always interesting because the names bounce around. Well, Mike, AAAK. Go ahead, Mike. Good business. Fine business. And let's see. Next, we have Tom.
And good evening to everyone in the group. Let's see, last week I put out the article on the very low cost cross loop receive antenna. We discussed it on the Hampside call, got a lot of good questions and discussion from folks. It's on the mailing. I put it out to both the Tangerine and the Hampside mailing lists last Thursday morning, and have been testing the preamp that I built for the ionospheric sounding experiments. It's very high dynamic range and very bad sensitivity. I built a version that's much better sensitivity. And due to local AM broadcast stations, I'm getting 5 volts peak to peak out of the amplifier from AM broadcast station. The SDR receiver can't handle that much. And even when I attenuate it, the preamp the high gain preamp is overloading. So we had a long discussion about that on Thursday, and I put together some thoughts on approaches to do that. My situation is my three AM stations are near the bottom end of the band and two near the top end of the band. And so I can't put a single notch in there to take them all out. And so from that experience, I kind of discussed perhaps devising a mid-stage amplifier configuration where in between the amplifier sections, we can put 50 ohm band stop filters or high pass or low pass filters, things like that, to try and make a more flexible kind of antenna. So anyway, it's out for review, and I hope I'll get some good concrete suggestions and I could prototype something there. So back to the group.
Fine business. And let's see, next on the list, I think we have Rob. Rob the Net.
Oh my goodness. I'm sorry. I showed up late because I was on the phone with the IRS.
Oh, geez.
Trying to get my refund after 90 days. I really, same thing. I'm working on my Whisper Daemon stuff and that's really about it. And I don't think that's of particular relevance to this group. So
I did try out some of your things and ran across a fellow, a VK that, or maybe it's VE, that was running your software and had a very nice set of graphs. And that was quite nice.
Oh, well, that's good. The big news with the release of WS, JTX version 2.2.1 last week, they included a superior improved decoding library for extracting spots from the WAV files. So there's some advances in the art of signal extraction, DSB processing, incorporated, which is now part of the my software, and of course other people, everyone who's running the new JTX gets it as well. About 5%, 6% more spots in a busy band, 20 meters in Europe. So looks like there's there's always room for improvement, I guess, in the world of radio.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you for your comments. And let's see, Veronica. We haven't talked to Veronica.
Hello, everyone. Hello. This week, Dr. Fussell has been helping me to learn how to analyze data with Python. And also, I've been working on Dr. Fussell's letting me borrow a computer from Scranton with more space on it. So I've been working on setting up things on that computer so I can start doing some more coding.
Well, very good. It's a good language to learn. Next on the list, we have Victor. Go ahead, Victor.
Hello, everyone. I have no new updates. I'm currently learning more about ham radio, so I've just ordered a couple of books, the Technician Edition. So I'm learning from that for now.
Very good. And let's see. Can't see anybody that I've missed, so I think we've gotten everybody. So we're open for general discussion.
Nathaniel, did you ever get any communications from someone named Vincent from University of North Dakota? You're muted.
Mute.
Is that Vincent Ledvina?
Yes.
And yeah, I know who he is.
He was asking not about hardware as much as he was asking about how they were going to store their pictures for the Aurorasaurus project.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if, I was hoping that I invited him to come here and maybe talk to Bill. And I don't know how mm-hmm. we could fit in their pictures, maybe with different metadata or something on the front. He says they're looking mm-hmm. they're looking for, I think, 2 terabytes a year is the amount of data that they're going to store. So it's a lot less than what we're doing. Let's see, it says here, no, 21 terabytes of total data per year. So I thought, well, if they could hook their cameras to the Odroid, then couldn't mm-hmm. they just tag their data as Aurora visual pictures and put it up alongside ours? I mean, wouldn't that be similar procedure?
Yep, that's exactly what we want to do. Yes.
Okay. Anyway, I've actually
talked to Liz McDonald and Liz McDonald about that idea in the past. So yes, it's exactly the sort of thing that I would like to be able to do.
Okay. Because I'm thinking that you could just plug the cameras in. He said one of the cameras is a micro B USB. So that should just plug right into the Raspberry Pi with an adapter. And he claims there's two cameras. They want to do a forward and backward, which is why they want to do that. But anyway, so if they can interface the cameras directly to the SBCs, then, I mean, they could really run Bill's software, right? I mean, is it that easy, or am I oversimplifying it?
Well, that's what I want it to be. So that's certainly my hope. I don't know if it's that easy, but that's the dream. The dream is to be able to have like one platform that kind of coordinates all these different instruments that you know measure, you know, different but related things. So yes.
I have to put a comment in here. Scotty says, the hardware is the hard part, and the rest of it's just software, which is easy.
Dump it all on Bill. And Bill will take care of it, right?
You should ask. Well, you should ask Bill.
It sounds like one of the major things we're going to have to do in a phase two of this project is ask NSF for a vast amount of money for storage, because you're talking about many terabytes per year. That adds up pretty quickly.
And
in cost. I mean, that's not something we're going to be prepared for in phase one, but going down the road, I can imagine. And another is going to be some of these plans are going to really only come to fruition after everybody has fiber to the desktop, because about, you know, a lot of real-time imaging and stuff like that, your regular run-of-the-mill DSL upload is not going to cut it. We'll get there over time, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I agree with all of that.
Even cable upload is pretty slow unless you get commercial.
What I would like to be able to do is, and this is the idea of being modular, is at least have the ability to be able to add extra instruments like, you know, like an auroral camera or something like that. And it's very possible, you know, so we basically do have, you know, one cohesive ecosystem. And I suppose it is, you know, it may be too much for one piece, for one Odroid to run all of these different things. But, you know, someone who's trying to run all of these different things may end up, you know, getting a more substantial computer that would have the resources to handle it. So
yeah,
if we can at least
probably,
have the if we have the software infrastructure in place. So it's essentially a personal space weather station operating system that opens the door to being able to work with people like Aurorasaurus and these other types of instruments.
Yeah, plus there's a lot of things you can do with additional architecture too. I mean, I have a very hot desktop, and I'm able to run a virtual VMware on it. So I can... Mm-hmm. All of the Windows stuff running at the same time as I'm running some of the Linux stuff at the same time, talking to the instrumentation and uploading and downloading. And, you know, if you want to do a lot of stuff all at once, it's going to take an architecture more than what you get on a single board computer. But, you know, the cost of this kind of equipment, it's not, we're going to break the bank either. I mean, for $1,500, you have a very hot desktop nowadays, very hot.
Mm-hmm.
And that can do all of that at once.
Yeah. And for someone who's really into this for someone who's really interested in this or for a, you know, funded research project, that's right. Absolutely fine.
Mm-hmm. I want to break in here. I got two things. I wanted to update on the magnetometer. David and Holman apparently had a very successful session getting Holman set up, and David is continuing to put upgrades to the GitHub for the magnetometers. So they're continually being things added. Jules and Holman have asked for lots of changes, and those are being added as they go along. And then I want to mention that Dave in 1HAC joined us a little late, just for the record.
Sorry, I got distracted by 6 meters.
Well, that's a good thing.
Did you work the VHF contest over the weekend?
I did. It was a lot of fun.
Amazing. Amazing. It was like 20 meters.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
David, what's that instrument in the background there?
Oh, I've got a couple of guitars. One's a Strat copy and one's a 12-string Spanish guitar.
Okay, thank you.
So relating to the antenna situation, Dev, Bill Lyles, MQ6Z, and myself have also been talking about options of what we can do to set up this ionosonde receiver in my backyard while we're waiting for, you know, a design from the Hamside Happer group. And one of we came up with two antennas we could buy right away. One of them is the passive AirSpy USPY antenna. Is anyone familiar with that?
I have one.
And so how does that work for you, Dave?
It works pretty well. It's a compromise antenna because it's tunes both lower HF and then also attempts to work on. It doesn't really get to UHF, but it goes up to 300 megahertz, I think. And there's a chunk in the middle that's cut out. But it's not cut out of the antenna, but the AirSpy equipment doesn't sense in that range. And I found it very good for local stuff. I'm still kind of trying to figure out how it works for longer range stuff. I've just had it in my room at the house here, not outside yet. And it's cheap enough. It's $35, but I don't know. I think it's got it's pretty much what Tom's doing. The one I have doesn't really have an amplifier.
Yeah, so it is a passive antenna. It does not have an amplifier. And it's also not waterproof, right?
No, it's not set up to be waterproof.
Right. So
but it does a lot better than a 2 meter whip.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what I usually use with RTL SDRs.
It is U-loop HF antenna.
Now I did get a small amp that's using that 5109 IC, and it came from Greece, and I haven't put it together yet, but I was going to try that.
Yeah, that'll
anybody
be interesting.
Else know,
note
know
that this that, is also usable on VHF.
Yes, it is.
They say it turns into a folded dipole.
Yeah, so it's very nice that it has such a broad response and it's so inexpensive.
I will tell you that these were back ordered for about 2 months, and it took a while to get them. I think they have a bunch now.
Yeah, we had heard that, and when Dev checked, they had a website that gave shipping date estimates, and they seem to be in stock.
Now, they're somewhere in Pennsylvania is the guy selling it, which I think is in Pittsburgh area.
Okay.
Now, this would not be a difficult antenna to duplicate. I may be wrong, but I think it uses the Mobius loop idea.
Yeah, you're right about that.
It seems to have a solid connector in the center.
Well, mm-hmm. If you look at the info on it, what's in the center is crossing over.
It crosses over at the top, yes.
Right.
So can we not duplicate that?
It would be easy to duplicate.
It's not that hard to antenna to.
No, what is that exactly in the fender? What is it called?
The connector. Bottom is just a a T, and then the top is a crossover. So the center pin connects to the shield, and the shield connects to the center pin on either side.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine. You're talking about duplicating this. It's hard for me to imagine that you're going to be able to beat this price buying the parts and putting it together yourself. I mean,
no, you can't.
Yeah.
Well,
unless you
it's just coax.
Unless you buy hundreds of them, hundreds of parts, and then you can get it down.
Yeah, we ordered two of them so far.
I have one, and I know Dave Witten has two.
Yeah. So this is an SMA connector on the bottom?
Correct.
Okay.
And there's
but about, for receive.
There's about
for nine, receive we can.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
There's about 9 feet, or no, maybe more like 6 or 7 feet of coax that comes out the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says 6 feet, 2 meters.
2 meters, yes.
Maximum power 250 milliwatts, so you can transmit it with it, sort of. FDA.
Sort of.
That would work with my Raspberry Pi Whisper.
Right. I think that's what they're intending it.
Yeah, you could use the Red Pataya transceiver with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or you could use a, well, you'd have to be careful, but a Penelope is 500 milliwatts, so you'd have to reduce the power.
Now, if we're using this for receive, we could probably feed this using RG6, right?
Yeah, I would think so. So
it doesn't say whether it's 50 ohms or 75 ohms, but...
No.
In looking at the connector for the feed line, it appears to be a different size than the other connectors.
Down here.
The one I have has a SMA on the bottom, the output.
Yeah.
And what
kind SMA of connectors? It's RG402 coax they're using.
Is that 50 or 75 ohm coax?
That's a good question.
I'm not clear.
50.
It's semi-rigid.
Right.
Yes, it is semi-rigid.
So that's the feed line that comes off the bottom?
Or is that's
the
feed line and its branches.
Yes.
Oh, okay. And then what's at the bottom of the feed line? Another SMA?
Yes. So then you could go into some other coax if you needed to put it outside somewhere.
But so you probably wouldn't want to use RG6 because that's 75 ohms.
Yeah.
It would probably work okay, but you get a mismatch there. On a receive, it would be all right.
You could put some sort of balun in the...
450 watts, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, what's this, 250 milliwatts?
Yeah. 450 watts would probably just arc right over that little receive transistor.
Yes. I think you just need to change the balun and you'll be fine for higher power.
Well, it's got an amplifier, right?
No,
it does not have an amplifier.
Oh, it's just passive. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's with the 250 milliwatts? That's silly.
Well, it's probably the balun that they're using that limits that.
Oh, that's in the bottom connector?
Right.
Bottom T there.
If you put your own balun in there, you could kick that up.
With my luck on AM, I'd probably overload that antenna.
You could hook LEDs up to the antenna port and light them up, right?
Mm-hmm. Performance DX and uses a low noise preamp. So they want you to use a preamp.
So on a different subject, Nathan, you were talking about the Yuha's chirp design,
mm-hmm.
and how it would fit into the Tangerine design.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk a little bit about that and maybe 10 gig E interface on the next generation when we get to it. So the question I have is, so he has two USRPs. So two virtual receivers, well, two real receivers, tuned to the same frequency, and he's got one on a horizontal or one on each of two loops that are 90 degrees out at right, so the cross loops. So he gets about 800 megabits of data out of each one of those USRPs, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does he feed that to? What kind of computer does he have that can handle that kind of data? Full, almost full board 2 gigabit Ethernet ports.
I think it's just, he was just using a standard tower, I think.
But so do you have any idea what algorithm he's doing with the data? Because that's, I presume the USRPs are simply just giving him IQ data.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's just IQ. I don't know the exact algorithms. I know that he's using GNU Radio and Python signal processing.
The algorithms are, I think, I would be downloading them tomorrow. But I don't think I have access to data. Like he does not. He said like he would not provide it. But the algorithms are available in his GitHub profile.
Okay, because I'm just wondering whether a GNU Radio flow graph is going to be able to handle that much data. And that, Tom, you probably have experience with more about that than I do. So, what do you think?
Yeah, it gets challenging. It depends on the PC. Some PCs can handle close to those rates. My question would be what the block diagram of his processor is. I have an idea that perhaps the very first block in the GNU Radio processor is the D chirper block, basically mixing the receive signal with a precisely timed chirp signal. And the result of those two is an offset frequency related to the time delay between the transmitter and the receiver. If that's the case, then what you get is a tone, basically, which is related to the distance. And that tone varies with the chirp frequency. And if that's done that way, there's an enormous reduction in data in that very first stage. And if he's doing that, we have options there where we could do the same thing in the FPGA, and that gives the advantage then that the personal space weather station can do a phenomenal amount of data reduction right up front in the FPGA, and then a whole bunch of folks can contribute their received measurements. So it'd be interesting to see what his block diagram looks like, because it would tell us if there are some points within the diagram we can all agree to standardize on formats and things.
Yeah, so we would define a format coming from the FPGA that would be this dechirped mixed output, right?
Right, right. And if that is in the same format that Yuha has, then we could develop compatible data sets, which would be nice. Plus, they would be very low data rates, so we could easily upload them from folks' homes.
So really what we have in the FPGA then, that first block, it would be an NCO, but it would be a swept NCO synchronized with the time of the transmitter, right?
Right, right. It would be a swept NCO that would be chirped at the same rate as the transmitter that you're interested in looking at, that has the same exact start time as the transmitter you're looking at. And I built one of those in GNU Radio in a Python block a couple of years ago using NumPy, and NumPy is incredibly efficient. If you write the Python block the correct way, it didn't really take very many resources at all. It ran quite efficiently.
Well, very interesting. So that would certainly be something that we could pull into the FPGA.
It'll be interesting to have a dialogue with Yuha, because he was definitely of the mind, like, even had a bullet point on his slide recommending to not do things in the FPGA because it limits who can modify the signal processing. Now, it's very, with that said, for the purposes of the personal space weather station, if we're trying to get this out to a lot of people at a low cost, it may make sense to pull some of that stuff over to the FPGA, or to, and basically to talk to Yuha, figure out where the right balance is on this particular project.
I'm also wondering if the something like the RSP Duo would do this. If he's trying to pull the processing out of the FPGA, we might be able to mock it up with something that already exists, and then Yeah, we can make choices of what should be in the tangerine.
What? Wait, what do you mean by the RSP Duo?
Do you know about the RSP Duo? The RSP 1A and the RSP Duo from SDR Play? They're really inexpensive SDRs.
Okay.
$100 to $250. The two channel is about $250.
I apologize. Maybe I missed it. So how does that FPGO come into play in this?
The FPGA is essentially programming. You're able to program all your math logic into hardware, and it gives you the ability to do repeated mathematical tasks extremely quickly. So it's very suited to signal processing. The disadvantage to FPGAs is that it's more difficult. I don't know if more difficult is the right word. It might be, but it's certainly not as common of a language to program in as, say, Python is. So if you're going to make any modifications to the FPGA code, you have to have it a harder to obtain skill set. So the less signal processing you do on the FPGA and the more you do on the general purpose computer, the easier it is for, you know, someone like you or me or, you know, someone who's not an FPGA specialist to be able to make modifications to it. The downside is you have to get that data from the FPGA, which is where basically all the first level processing happens. You have to get that data from the FPGA onto the computer, and then you need a more expensive computer. So the more processing that you do on the FPGA, the less expensive you can make the hardware, because you don't need as fast of a data throughput between the FPGA and the computer, and you can use a cheaper computer.
Yeah, so go ahead.
I'm wondering what exactly he is doing with that. Reading his description, he's talking about it. Where was it? Oh, custom GNU radio signal processing block that can be used to down-convert chirps, store them into narrowband files. That's very much what we're doing with the AM Doppler project. Doing FFTs to just get a very narrow band around the signal of interest. I'm wondering if he's actually scanning the center frequency to keep up with the chirp. But if you can get enough bandwidth to a PC, you can probably do it over there.
Yeah, the advantage that he has by capturing IQ is that at a later time, he could go ask the question, were there multiple different ionosons on, and can we go look at those different ones?
Well, actually, that's not how I read it. I think he's storing a very small portion of the data that's coming out of the actual A to Ds in the USRP.
Which means that the FPGA code would probably not change very much, because that would be kind of a fixed block at the front end.
Right. I think he's just doing a particular form of down converter in the FPGA.
Yeah, it sounds like basically a dechirper processing. And if we could do something like that and then have a common format, then the vast majority of the DSP code or the GNU radio code could operate on those narrow band data sets in a compatible way.
No, well, I'm interested in this one down here that says chirp view, program for using narrow band ham radio receivers for chirp sounding.
Now, one thing I should say, this is Yuha's website from a few years ago. Since he now has left the Sedangkai La Geophysical Observatory that's hosting this website, and he's now at the University of Tromsø. So he doesn't update this website anymore, but he's continued to do quite a bit of work. And 2 weeks from this Thursday, we're going to have a special HamSci telecon at 3 p.m. on July 2nd. I haven't announced this to the list yet, but Yuha will give a presentation on the current status of his work, and he'll be able to answer all of your questions in person that you have about this. And he also said he'd be willing to help us with help us with what we need. he also has a piece of software that he's working on where he said you actually don't need a GPSDO in order to detect, to decode the ionosondes. He does have a way of identifying these and finding, detecting them without a GPSDO, but it sounded rather computationally intensive. I think some of these ideas, it seemed like something where you could play some really nice games with having a network of distributed instruments where you have some receivers do the work of detecting the ionosondes and some other receivers do the work of actually analyzing the data. But I think when you see his presentation, I think a lot of these things, I think it'll really get a lot of our brains thinking.
Nathaniel, maybe please allow me to ask a question. So, you were saying that he has some other arrangement in which we don't need GPSDO.
He does have. So
my question is. I want to think along from the very basic. So why would we need a GPSDO in the first place, and how would he have circumvented that need?
Dev, pull your mic away from you. We're getting a lot of shirt noise.
Okay, sorry.
I think how does he circumvent that need? I think we'd have to ask him that a little bit more. I don't know the details of his code. What does the GPSDO do for us? It provides us a remarkably stable signal reference and timestamping. And it gives us the, I think the dual frequency module that we're looking at using also gives us the ability to measure TEC. So there are a lot of advantages to having the GPSDO.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So it will be more interesting to learn like how he gains those advantages without using these.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the other thing is having ours synchronized both in frequency and time isn't as important for an application like this where you're doing bringing down two channels in the same receiver, as long as they're frequency locked to one another, phase locked. But if we have stations widely separated, and we try to do anything that is akin to interferometry, it's very useful to have these tightly locked.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I would like to mention that on his webpage, about halfway down, there is a download spot and there's a GNU radio UHA TAR that has the code that he says he was using in 2013.
He has it on GitHub too. Dev, do you remember his GitHub page?
I do. Give me a second, okay? I'll send that in chat. Like I have followed him, so I should be very easily finding him. Okay, give me one second. I'm looking for it.
Okay. Actually, I'll probably say
I found it. Okay.
You found it?
Yeah.
Do you want to put it in the chat?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Great. There you go. So this should have the answer to everyone's questions about algorithms because this should be the latest code. Looks like he's planning on moving away from GNU Radio.
Then he would probably welcome the dechirping in the FPGA.
Yeah.
The question is how much of the algorithm that he plays with and modifies and experiments with is outside of that first block? Is it mostly outside of the first block? In which case, you know, we give him that format of data and then he doesn't really need to mess with it anymore. He just takes it and processes it.
Yeah, I think that's something I'll have to discuss with him about
I will mention, though, for those that are time sensitive, we're just over an hour.
I've gotten the call for dinner, so I'll see you next week. Thank you. 73 is all.
73.
Well, I think this will be, I'm really excited that we'll be able to work with Yuha. I think it's going to really help with this part of the project. In fact, the more I talk with him, the more I'm not sure that we could really make fast progress on Ionosonde detection and decoding without his help. But I think this is going to be very, very useful.
Aside from being an exciting project.
Yeah.
This is super exciting. This is really good.
Well, so anyone have anything else? Seems like we're kind of winding down here.
It is about time.
Yes, we're.
Have you been able to find this radius, Scotty?
I found 3 sets of filters so far. So
filters.
The
you need a radio to go with it.
The Alex filters, I found those. So I will get them out. I will find them. I'll have a lot more time on July 7th after we're out building, if I survive that long.
Moving is so tough.
Oh, and it's 106 degrees out today, so it's kind of cool. So in fact, after the conference, this is over, I've got to go drive over to the storage shed and dump a bunch of stuff off that I loaded up in the truck before I came home. So never ending pile of stuff.
You ought to hire some of those Boy Scouts.
Yeah. Are you kidding? They won't work for me for that. They won't do that kind of work. No, I can't get them to, I've got them to volunteer to lift the golf cart batteries that I've been hoarding for the past about 8 years. I have 3 sets of them, of which I don't believe any of them are any good. And there's 8 per set, and they weigh about 75 pounds each. So I have 24 batteries at 75 pounds each, and we got to take them in. They're in the building, so I have to take them to the back for cores.
Yeah. So you have a fortune in the lid.
Well, you know, the guy, we get free batteries every 2 years or 3 years. We go to the local Interstate battery guy. And he says, oh, you're with the Explorer Post Scouts? Here, have a set of batteries. And what he does is he gives me, they supply batteries to RVs. And when a set of batteries comes back that is marked as bad, they might find one bad battery in the batch. Well, they have to take the whole batch out of service and give them all new batteries. So then they have these batteries that are slightly used that they can't sell. So he gives them to us to use it in our field day expeditions. But of course, this year, no field day for big groups, so we don't really need batteries. But over the years, I've never given him any cores back, and he's really wants the cores back because, I mean, he gives us the batteries for free, right? I mean, it's like $1,800 worth of batteries he gives us, and so the least I can do is give him the cores back when we're done. I mean, realistically, I could take them to the recycler. I could probably get $15, $20 a battery because they're 70 pounds at least each.
Yeah.
But I'll give them back to him because he helps us out every time we need it. So, but I got to get, 3,000 pounds worth of batteries over to his place. But we have a school bus. We have a school bus. Why are you kidding? That's a piece of cake for school bus.
Oh, okay. Anyway.
One of the guys in the Explorer Post has a 3/4 ton pickup. So we can overload that easy.
Well, I guess we're done.